told you were quite cold and are suffering from a head wound, so I wouldn't be so certain that you had what you think you had."
"I'm certain, love."
"Women do not typically propose to men. Certainly not women like me. Certainly not men like you."
"Women like you?"
"Wallflower spinsters, forlorn felicities."
"Lady Lockpick, did you or did you not ask me to marry you?"
"I believe it was less asking and more telling."
"Do it again."
Her blush turned to flame.
"No."
He pressed a kiss to her temple.
"Please."
"No." She pulled away from him and kept walking.
"So traditional," he scoffed.
And then, after a moment, he called after her.
"Felicity."
She turned back to find him on his knees in the brightly lit courtyard. She took a step toward him, already reaching for him, thinking for a moment that he had fallen again. He clasped her outstretched hand and pulled her closer until her skirts were billowing around him. She froze, staring down into the face of the man she loved as he said,
"I haven't much. I was born with nothing, was given nothing. I haven't a name worthy of you, nor a past I'm proud of. But I vow here, in this place that I have built, that used to mean everything and now means nothing without you, that I will spend the rest of my life loving you, and I will do all that I can to give you the world."
She shook her head. "I don't want the world."
"What then?"
"You," she said simply. "I want you." He smiled, the most beautiful smile she'd ever seen.
"You've had me since that first night, love. Now tell me what else you want."
She blushed. Her heart pounded when he removed the band from his ring finger, immediately transferring it to her thumb, following the kiss of warm silver with his own kiss, to the metal and then to her knuckles. There would be a wedding, no doubt, but this moment here, in this place, felt like ceremony, blessed by sunlight and air. And when the husband of her heart rose to his feet, towering over her with broad, beautiful shoulders, his hands coming to her cheeks, cupping her jaw, tilting her face up to his, Felicity gave him the kind of kiss a queen of Covent Garden gave her king. When it was over, he turned to the rooftops, and Felicity's gaze followed his to the rooftops around the warehouse yard, where dozens of men stood at scattered intervals, rifles at their sides, grins on their faces, watching. She blushed, and the blush turned to flame as he called out as strong as ever,
"My lady!"
He kissed her, long and slow and deep, until the men assembled pounded their feet and shouted their congratulations down into the yard, creating a magnificent cacophonous echo reverberating around the buildings, so thunderous that the tremors in her toes sent wild pleasure through her. Pleasure that turned to fire when he pulled her close and whispered at her ear,
"Your world awaits, my love."
Epilogue. 3 months later. Felicity came to Devil's Side in the courtyard of the Bare Knuckle Bastards' Covent Garden warehouse as the final steel wagon left the drive, Wit at the reins. Devil's arm pulled her tight to him as the September wind blew, sending her skirts billowing around them, and they stood, king and queen of Covent Garden, until the clatter of the horse's hooves faded into the night. When it was gone, replaced by the voices of the watch on the rooftops above, and the men who had spent the night working to get the shipment out for delivery, she tilted her face up to his and smiled. "Another day done." He turned to face her, his hands cupping her cheeks, holding her still as he kissed her, long and deep, until they were both gasping for air.
"It's late, wife," he said. "You should be abed."
"I prefer my bed with you in it," she teased, loving the little growl he gave at the words. "Call me wife again." He leaned down and pressed his lips to the soft skin of her neck.
"Wife."
He scraped his teeth at the place where her neck met her shoulder.
"Wife."
Nipped at the curve there.
"Wife."
She shivered, her arms coming up around his neck. I don't think I shall ever tire of it, husband. He lifted his head and met her eyes, his own dark in the moonlight.
Not even when you remember that you married into the darkness.
The wedding, performed by special license days after Felicity had rescued Devil from the ice hold, had been perfect, and the opposite of everything Felicity had once imagined. Instead of a staid affair at St. Paul's Cathedral, attended by half the contents of Burke's peerage, it had been a lively, cacophonous celebration at a different St. Paul's, a stone's throw from the Covent Garden Market. To Felicity's parents' chagrin, it had been performed by the rookery's vicar, a man who knew his ale and drank it well, to a congregation packed to the gills with the bastards' men and their families. Arthur had been there, of course, and Prue, along with a collection of tarnished aristocrats, who had taken Felicity, Devil, and the whole of the Faircloth family under their collective wing. After all, the Duchess of Haven had pointed out at the wedding breakfast that morning, scandals must stick together. Only Grace had been missing from the celebration. She remained in hiding while the bastards worked to find Ewan, who had disappeared after leaving London months earlier. A package had been delivered before the ceremony from Madame Hébert, however, and inside, Felicity had discovered a pair of perfectly tailored buckskin breeches, a beautiful white shirt, a pink and silver waistcoat that would rival any frock in Mayfair, and a tailored topcoat, black on the outside with pink satin lining. Along with the clothes, a pair of tall leather boots fitted over the knee. A proper ensemble, fit for a Covent Garden queen. And with it, a message. Welcome, sister. That evening, there had been a riotous celebration in the garden, where Lady Felicity Faircloth, now Mrs. Felicity Colne, had received her third name, the one she treasured the most of all, the bastard's bride. It had been the perfect wedding day, Felicity thought, made better by night, when her new husband had found her in a crush of laughing well-wishers, taken her hand and led her to the roof of his Covent Garden offices to watch hundreds of paper lanterns released into the sky from the rooftops all around them. After she'd gasped her delight and thrown herself into his arms, he'd given her the kiss she demanded and knocked his walking stick twice upon a tin chimney nearby, dismissing the elves who had helped him before delivering his new wife to a bed of silk and fur beneath the starlit sky. Felicity shivered with the memory of that night, and Devil pulled her closer.
Are you cold, my love?
No, she smiled, just full of memories. He smiled into her hair.
Good ones.
The very best, she said, looking up at him through her lashes. Though it occurs that it is September, and soon we shan't be able to use the rooftops. One black brow rose in keen understanding of what she was saying, of what she was wanting.
I think you underestimate my power, Felicity Faircloth.
She smiled. Felicity Colne, if you please. And I wouldn't dream of underestimating you, Devil. Indeed, I cannot imagine the weather ever denying your wishes. He nodded and leaned close, letting his voice go low and dark.
Winter on the rooftops shall be even better than summer.
Her eyes went wide. Shall it?
I'm going to spread you out beneath the snow and see how hot I can make you burn, my beautiful flame.
She went hot as the sun. I don't suppose I could lure you to a rooftop now to practice, could I, my handsome moth? He straightened.
No.
No?
No. I've something to show you.
He took her hand in his, leading her away from the warehouse and back toward the bright lights of Drury Lane. They stopped at the Singing Sparrow, full of their men, drinking and celebrating a night's hard work. Holding the door for her, Devil followed Felicity inside, with a nod to the proprietor, toward a place on the floor that had been cleared for dancing. A quartet of strings and pipes were nearby, and Devil pulled her into his arms as the musicians began to dance. She laughed up at him when he spun her in a surprising circle.
You wish to show me this tavern?
He shook his head.
There was a time when you told me that you didn't think I was the kind of man who danced.
She remembered.
And are you?
I never was before. Dancing seemed like the kind of thing that people did when they were happy.
Her gaze flew to his. And you weren't?
Not until you.
She nodded, her fingers playing over his shoulder. And then she met his eyes and said, "Show me."
He did, pulling her close enough to scandalize Mayfair, rocking her and lifting her and swinging her and spinning her in time to the whirling, wonderful music.
She clung to him, his strong arms keeping her safe and his. He spun her again and again, faster and faster along with the music, their assembled audience clapping in time, until she threw her head back and laughed, unable to do anything else. And then he was lifting her into his arms and carrying her through the tavern and out into the street, where a fine autumn mist had turned the cobblestones gold in the light. He set her down as she caught her breath, kissing the last lingering laugh from her lips.
"Well, wife,"
she shook her head. "It wasn't like a dream." He scowled, and she laughed again, reaching for him. "My love, my devil, it was better. It was real." He kissed her again, long and deep. And when he lifted his head, he was smiling, wide and wicked and wonderful. She matched the smile with her own, coming up on her toes to whisper in his ear, "Love me, past, present, and future." His answer came like flame.
"Yes."
And now, listen to an interview with Sarah McLean and her editor, Carrie Farron.
So today, I'm talking with Sarah McLean, best-selling historical romance novelist, whose book you just listened to. And Sarah has won a Rita. She is a romance columnist for the Washington Post, and of course, she's a New York Times bestseller. And I am very lucky to have worked with Sarah for almost 10 years now through 4 historical romance series. And this is the launch of a new one. And this series is strikingly different from what you've done before, Sarah. Although I think that in the past you kind of delved into the underworld a little bit, but you had like an out because the people were aristocratic. But this one, you went for it.
Right.
So tell us about that.
I did dance around the underworld a lot. I feel like my whole career has been moving toward this idea of every space has a king. And I wanted to write a series about kings who weren't aristocratic, who weren't dukes and marquises and earls. Although, of course, there is a duke in this series, which readers will now know, now that they've finished their book. And I wanted to go back to, I had spent time in this kind of casino-y, edgy, criminal world. I'd sort of danced around this kind of dark world, darker world in the Rules of Scoundrels series, which is focused on a casino. And it's 4 books, and each of those heroes are aristocrats who had fallen from grace in some way. And I moved away from that series to talk about women in the world, and I wrote Scandal and Scoundrel, which was very much about sisters and sisterhood. And when it came time to think of a new series, I had sort of always wanted to go back to that idea of the darkness. And Scandal and Scoundrel.
In some ways, it's interesting to me because in this book, the hero actually feels like he has more power than any duke that you've ever written about. And I think that's so interesting because you would imagine that people like to read about dukes because it's about power, but this is real power. And what was it like to write about that?
Freeing. Because you're right. I really like to write about men who have jobs. And that's hard to do all the time when you're writing about aristocrats, which I think is why I wrote about these 4 aristocrats who owned a casino, or I wrote about, you know, a man who owned a newspaper, or any variety of things I've written, a person who, a duke who owned a distillery. And I think jobs give people purpose,
structure,
and structure, and they make them passionate in different ways. Idle richness is not compelling to me very much.
Also, it makes people have goals, which is really important in storytelling.
Right, and will become very important over the course of this series, these kind of, this idea of these, the bare-knuckle bastards, two men and a woman, having to come together to protect what is their turf, essentially, and their kingdom.
Okay, let's start with the title, Bare-Knuckle Bastards. Where does that come from? How did you think of it?
I knew, truthfully, the whole arc of the series came with this idea that I wanted to write about three fallen men, or three men who had come to their kingdoms by chance. And also, the whole idea of this series was about me wanting to come back to this idea of men and women who had to pull themselves up from the dirt. And I knew I wanted to write about bastards because there is something very fascinating about this idea of name and destiny and that kind of missed opportunity. And so I came up with this idea of these four children who had all kind of been manipulated and by this powerful man.
Well, yes, and by accident of birth, they really were stripped of their birthright. So that's pretty interesting.
Right. And I knew that it would have to be a kind of Hunger Games-y style exile for them from the world that might have been, the life that might have been, the life they might have had. And so when you're a child in 1830, whatever, and you are exiled from your home or
your biological family, really.
Right. Your father. You don't really have a choice. You end up in Covent Garden. Maybe you end up in the Rookeries. You end up in the darker side of London. You end up in this world that's very cruel. And I got really interested in what it would take to make kings and queens in this world. And so that was it. And so obviously at the beginning, these are children. They land in Covent Garden at 10 or 12 and they have to fight. And so
that's what's so interesting is the fighting. Like they're actually taught to fight by their father. And then it becomes a way of life.
Right.
And what I need to know is, are you obsessed with Fight Club? Like,
well, for a long time, before I think I even pitched it to you, there was this idea in my, to all my friends, it was Regency Fight Club.
Right.
You know, when are you going to write Regency Fight Club? And now, of course, readers know that not all of them use their fists anymore.
Right.
Though you'll start to see over the course of the series how the fists come into play. But surely, I mean, I wrote No Good Duke Goes Unpunished and Temple is a bare-knuckle boxer.
Right.
Though he follows the rules in a way that these men and women do not.
So it's a really interesting world that you've created. And one of the things that really struck me about this book is it's almost completely at night. It takes place at night and you have the sensation while you're reading it of just this gloom and London and lights and, but how did you think of that and what did you do to find the different information and research for this book? Did you go to primary sources? Did you read other books? Did you do it in the United States? What's the story?
I always start in London because it's a good excuse to go there.
So you actually went to London.
Yeah.
And you went to libraries there?
I did. I do a fair amount of work at the British Library. So I always start in London. I did go there for this book. And I knew I wanted to write in Covent Garden and I didn't know Covent Garden short of what you read in romance novels about Covent Garden.
Because now it's completely sanitized.
It's
and
so
lovely
posh.
Shops. You can have tea.
Oh, it's so posh and amazing. And so aside from the kind of primary source research that I did historically, which exists in droves at the British Library, there is a magnificent collection of maps in the Museum of London. An anthropologist named Charles Booth took a bunch of students around London to literally map the poverty levels of every block. And that is...
When was that?
In the 1860s.
So close
a little
to
later.
A little later, but close to
close
enough.
But remarkably, this map is, it's color-coded and it's enormous and digitized. And so at the Museum of London, you can go and go block by block to look at the poverty levels. And Covent Garden is impoverished. It's where many of the warehouses existed that made London tick. And for me, that was why I was so interested in this world, because I started to really think about London as a city that is, all cities are built by working class. All cities are built by the poor, and they're ruled by the rich, but are they really? And that's where the bastards kind of came from, these sort of kings of London who build London with their hands along with their men.
So when you were researching all this and doing block by block, is this when you found out about the ice business? Is ice something you always meant to write about, or is it something that came through your research? Because it is a pretty fascinating part of the book.
It's really, my husband would tell you that he thinks that it's because I was watching a lot of Frozen with our toddler. When I plotted this book, which may be true, but I don't think so. When I was in London, I met a man in a bar, in Covent Garden, knowing that I was going to write about Covent Garden. I was trying to sort of think about, how to pin the story in space, which is always really important to me when I come to a book, like what are the locations that are going to become essential to this series? And I knew that these were going to be crime lords in some way, but I wanted them to be noble. I didn't want them to run, you know, drugs or women or weapons or, people. And so for me, it was very important that what they were running was contraband that shouldn't really have been contraband, liquor, playing cards, dice, which
were playing cards and dice actually forbidden then?
Heavily taxed. Everything that they run is taxed to like 300 or 400% by the crown.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it all sort of beautifully knit. Sometimes things just fall into place and it knitted together really well with, you know, my casino series and the series that I wrote that had a bar in it, or a tavern in it. So, I got really excited about Covent Garden, and so I was sitting in a bar in Covent Garden, and I met an older man who I don't remember the name of, who told me a story about how his grandfather used to bring blocks of ice through Covent Garden and sell ice, essentially sweet ice, in Covent Garden. He would put them on a cart and it would ring a bell. I mean, we see it here in New York City, and I'm sure
shaved ice.
Yeah,
you mean like shaved ice.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, lemon ice or raspberry ice. And I got really interested in ice in general and how ice existed in the world, because keeping things cold, you know, we talk so much about plumbing and technology as being important to changing the world, but being able to keep food cold, really made a huge difference for communities.
Yeah, I can't even imagine, because when you think about it, being out of power for a few days ruins everyone's food and 100 years ago.
And if you were poor.
Yeah.
So there's actually a moment in very early in this book where Devil and Wit, the two brothers, they're standing in Covent Garden in the rookery, and it's articulated that this rookery, you know, there's been a shipment of ice, and so finally, they can keep all the meat cold, the offal shops, which, I mean, basically when you were poor, you ate whatever was left of the meat, that all the meat could be cold. And so
right,
people would be able
salted,
to eat,
you know, or yeah, preserved in some way.
And so, it's really interesting. It just became fascinating to me. And then I sort of thought, well, it would be really great if they could smuggle within these sort of ice ships, because of the way ice was, and this is all in the book.
That's so interesting.
But how the ice comes in on ships that are nearly sunken into the Thames because there's so much melt. And they're literally sinking from inside the ship. I got really excited about it, and hopefully it's exciting and interesting to readers too.
I'm leading people into the wrong direction. There's a lot about the characters in this book too. Let's talk about Felicity, because we meet her in a really interesting way at the beginning of the book.
Right. She has, escaped a sort of shameful experience inside a ballroom, and she picks a lock and lands herself in the proximity of devil, the hero.
She picks a lock to escape the shameful situation where basically people are gossiping about her.
Yeah, I wanted
to. It's a mean girl moment.
It is. And I think it's a mean girl moment in a way that for me felt very important, because I feel like we've all, every person in the world who's ever been in a friendship has at some point or another had a moment where that friendship wasn't quite what they thought it was going to be, or it wasn't as powerful as they thought it was, or important as they thought it was, or it wasn't as reciprocal as they thought it was. And for Felicity, I think she sort of falls out of favor with a group of people who she thought were her friends and then realizes she has no one. And it's embarrassing and sad, and it really makes her rethink her whole identity as a person at the center of the aristocracy. And then
she's a pretty interesting person. But maybe explain to people how you came to the idea of lock picking and why that was so interesting to you. Did that come from your research too? And what is it about a woman picking locks that you thought was intriguing?
Right. Well, I think there are a couple of things. I got really excited at the beginning of the series. When I was plotting the series, I was listening to this incredible podcast called 99% Invisible, which is produced by a man named Roman Mars. And it's about design in general. And there's an incredible episode of this podcast that's about this idea of perfect security. And essentially the concept is there is no such thing as perfect security, but for about 40 or 50 years in the middle of the 1700s and 1800s, there was perfect security because there was a lock called a Chubb lock and no one could pick it. It was unpickable. And the story is really magnificent and involves a world's fair where an American wanders in and says, I can pick the Chubb lock. And there's a bounty on the lock where if you can pick it,
it's like LifeLock today. No, it is. In the beginning, there was like a monetary compensation if something happened to you because they thought it was so unpickable. But
right.
In the beginning, it was a physical lock.
Right. It was this physical lock. And to the point where there was a legendary lockpick who had been thrown into prison in London, and they gave him the Chubb lock and said, if you can pick this, you get to be free. And it took him 30 days and he couldn't do it, and he ultimately gave up. But his freedom was on the line and he couldn't do it. And then this American wandered in and said, I can pick it. And it was the great lock scandal of whatever date. And I got really fascinated by this idea, this unpickable lock, and how the world kind of feels unpickable to women at times. And Felicity, her work with locks and the moment she picks a lock feels like she's gaining freedom every time and gaining access to doors that have been closed to her, paths that have been shut to her, and people who she might never have known. And so her lock picking becomes a very critical piece of the puzzle.
It's a metaphor for her life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really fun.
And of course, writing this book and this time, locks, it does feel like things are locked to us.
Again.
Yeah. Fun fact, my mom tried to get into her safe while I was working on this book, and she broke the key or couldn't get into it. And she said, I need to take it to a locksmith. And I was like, no, I can do it. I've read books and watched YouTube videos, and I broke into that safe in about 3 minutes, and I have never felt so powerful. I'm drunk with power.
That's amazing.
I feel like the whole world is open to me now. Let's go on the lam.
Thelma and Louise, we will be.
Exactly.
thinking about the heroine also makes me realize like how interconnected all of your books are and how you've created this whole world. Like, this is one book and it's a new series, but it connects back to many other books that you've written. And I don't know, at some point, are you going to draw a huge genealogical table or, how else are you going to?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think it might be fun.
I do love when I'm reading. I'm, a romance reader first. And I say that all the time, but it still feels like I get jittery when I'm around other romance novelists because I love reading romance so much. But my favorite thing about romance novels is when you pick up a new series from an author you love, And suddenly you see familiar faces, familiar places, familiar concepts that have been laid out through the 20 books before. I think it's also sort of easier when you can say, I don't need to make up a new dressmaker. Madame Hébert is always the dressmaker in my books. And she's very talented. I'm just getting nervous as they progress forward. At some point, Madame Hébert is going to die.
Oh, no.
She needs a second.
Maybe she should start training somebody on screen right now. So that you can go forward with that.
But this was really interesting, writing these smugglers, because playing cards, as I said, dice were heavily taxed, bourbon, American bourbon, French brandy, these things were heavily taxed by the crown. And I've laid out in earlier books places that need these things. So the bastards provide playing cards and dice to the fallen angel. They provide American brandy to Caleb Calhoun, who owns the Singing Sparrow in Day of the Duchess. So it's just a fun way of tying everything together and laying little Easter eggs for everybody.
That's really fun. Let's talk about the cover a little bit. I just love this cover. I think it's so pretty. Really dramatic and it's beautiful. Like, a lot of times you have women on the covers and you like them to look a very particular way. What do you think that you're signaling to the readers with your covers? Like, what do you think you're signaling about what a Sarah McLean book is when you have these women and their aspects on the cover?
I think a Sarah McLean heroine is always very strong. She's the princess who would rescue herself. And often does, and often rescues the prince. And for me, that's always essential. And so for me, when we go through cover meetings, and this cover was my first time to get to go to a cover shoot and see how everything is done and how it's made.
What surprised you about that?
First of all, I was very surprised, honestly, that there were dresses that were there's a costumer at the shoot, and she's brought clothes from the time period, which is always amazing, because also I had sort of always thought that they were just draped in fabric and then everything was done in, you know, post. But she was there with like stockings and cane. Devil carries a cane sword, so there was a lot of discussion about, well, should there be a cane or should there not be a cane? And she had brought multiple canes for me to look at. And so for me, that was all really interesting. And then, of course, the actual photographs. I think what becomes amazing is starting to see how a model really makes a cover happen. This woman, and I wish I could remember her name, but this woman, she's so talented and she has such an expressive face, and she really did make the whole cover work. But for me, I sort of knew from the beginning that this book was going to be set in the dark, mm-hmm. and it had to feel like it was a really different location.
Yeah, it feels very modern to me. Yeah. Modern while being historical, which I think,
we changed the fonts, yeah, and mm-hmm. we wanted it to feel like it wasn't like,
we didn't want to do the same old, same
historicals.
Old.
Yes. Yeah.
We want to bring historicals to a new generation.
That's the hope.
And we want to lure them in, because I think that your books are very modern and deal with a lot of issues that women are dealing with today. So, and I think that's what actually makes them fun. So the next book,
Brazen and the Beast.
Awesome title.
It is Wit's story. Wit is what his brother and sister call him, but everybody else calls him Beast. And he is left at the end of this book, running the show, essentially. He's in charge of this business because Devil's still working in the business, but now he has this other piece of his life that he adores, and that's taking up part of his time. And Wit has nothing. Wit has his family and his men and his business and his
family are his half brothers.
Right. His half brother and his sister, who is not biologically his sister, but
right.
for all intents and purposes.
We'll get to her later. She'll be in the next interview.
His family is, you know, are his siblings, and his and Witt's family are his men. I mean, his the people who work for him, the men and women who live in the Rookery, who live in Covent Garden, who he feels really connected to, and who are very important. And everything that Witt cares about is threatened by another business, a business that is about to be inherited by a 29-year-old woman who has decided that she doesn't want to marry. She wants to run her father's business and, you know, own her own life. And her name is Hattie. And she is about to head off and have one night of experiencing the pleasure that a woman might find if she were to be married. And she gets into the carriage and finds an unconscious Witt tied up in the carriage. And he's very inconvenient. And things move on from there.
Oh, it sounds fun.
But what's really interesting about this book, I think, is that it is so much about Witt's responsibility, his almost misplaced sense of having to take care of everything, of everyone around him. And this idea that at some point responsibility becomes, it ties you up, essentially.
Literally.
Yeah. And you need a woman who's very good with ropes.
This whole series is going to be great.
I hope so.
Yeah, no. I like all of your series. Do you have a favorite?
Or
is the one you're writing always your favorite?
Well, I really love the setting of this one, and I hope readers will too. It's so different and it's really exciting, and I love the idea of, you know, London rooftops in the rain and things like that, which I never got to really do. I haven't done in other series. But I mean, the Fallen Angel, the casino is so important to me. As I said earlier, this idea of locations as set pieces has always been something that I've done. And so for me, you know, the Fallen Angel was like Hogwarts. You know, there were rooms of requirement, and there was, so every book had a different thing.
Even tiny little details in different books about settings have been great. I think back to the house where everything was decorated in the theme of dogs.
Right, that's A Scott in the Dark, but yes. Yeah, and
that
then
was fun.
And for me, those set pieces are so important. They're so important in other books that I love that it makes sense that I would put them all here. But
well, we're all really excited about your new book. And it's going on sale
June 19th. But this will be, you will already, readers listening to this will already have read it.
Yeah, that's true.
So
I want to talk just a little bit about your other life, working for the Washington Post. And I know that you read many, many books.
Mm-hmm. I have a very lucky second job.
Yes, you do. But I was just wondering, is there, a book that you feel like influenced you more than any other book being a romance writer?
One book?
One book.
Oh my gosh. I try to write black moments like Judith McNaught. That's my goal. And one time, one editorial letter from you early days, you said, make this more like Judith McNaught. And I mean, A Kingdom of Dreams it's very old school, and but it has this magnificent black moment at the end where there's a tournament and the hero's almost dead and the heroine has to run across the field to save him. And it's
very cinematic.
Oh, they're delicious. Yes. Yeah, somebody needs to make those books into movies. So that's for me, the end of every book. When I plot a book, I always plot from the ending back. And I plot from the black moment back. And I think part of the reason why is because of Judith.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that about your process.
I almost never know what is happening. Actually, I really never know what's happening. But I always know when I say black moment, for those of you listening, what I mean is the moment where the readers and the characters and oftentimes the author feel like all is lost and it's never going to work itself out. And that usually happens, you know, right at the end of the book. And for me, there's nobody who does that better than Judith McNaught.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you,
Always
Carrie.
Always fun to spend time with you.
I'm really so thrilled about this series, and thank you so much for your... It wouldn't be what it is without you.
Oh, that's so sweet, but... we never get a chance to talk like this, usually.
No. With microphones.
With microphones.
It's all very professional.
This is the first time in 10 years we've talked on a microphone, so maybe this will be our new way of communicating.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening. It's an honor to have you.
This is Justine Eyre. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Wicked and the Wallflower. The Bare Knuckle Bastards, Book 1, by Sarah McLean. Presented by Avon and Harper Audio. This program was produced by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director, Executive Producer Jennifer Lopes. Copyright 2018 by Sarah Trabucchi. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.